Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we talk with Congresswoman Barbara Lee, a progressive icon from the East Bay in Northern California. She is somebody who has been serving in public service for decades in California, somebody who was best known perhaps for being against the Afghanistan war back in 2001. That fight has been on for 20 years, finally making real progress on that front. We'll talk about that in a moment, but we talked to her on a really busy news week, a week when Kamala Harris is visiting the border, a week on where it seems like there's a bipartisan agreement potentially on infrastructure, a week where Derek Chauvin is sentenced. We'll talk about all that. We'll talk about also Juneteenth and her role in making that a national holiday, her being on stage with the president as it happened. So a really interesting, in-depth conversation with a view from the left. So here is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Congresswoman Lee, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you for having me. Nice seeing you.
All right, we'll talk more about Afghanistan in a moment, but let's begin in El Paso, Texas, which is literally where you began. That's your hometown. Kamala Harris's hometown, of course, in your district. You've been a friend and mentor to her for years. What did you make of the trip?
Well, I wish I could have been with her, but I'm in Washington, D.C. We had some major work to do here. But let me just tell you, I'm so pleased that she went to my hometown, El Paso, Texas. I have visited many times, very recently, of course, a couple of months ago. And it's important, I think, for her to really be in El Paso for many reasons, but her message and her job as vice president in terms of addressing the underlying issues that give rise to migration have to be addressed. And I serve as the chair of the subcommittee that funds much of our diplomatic and humanitarian and development assistance. And we work very closely together to make sure that the challenges that are faced by the people in Central America are really addressed at the root level.
Of course, she did not visit the Rio Grande Valley, where we're seeing some of those really dramatic pictures of people crossing recently. So what do we do? How do we address those migrant issues? How do we fix it?
There are so many levels to this, so many challenges and complexities. But the bottom line is we have to lead with our values. We have to make sure that the children who have been in these, in many respects, they've been deplorable places, that they get into homes and to the shelters right away. I know that the time limit now has been reduced quite a bit, which when I was there recently, they were staying, you know, they were being held for much too long before getting out. But now we're trying to ensure that there's more staff, social workers, mental health workers, professionals to be able to get them to their sponsors or their relatives. But we have to make sure that the resources are there for the issues around security, for the issues around economic development. Of course, there have been hurricanes and natural disasters in these countries, but people want to stay at their home. I haven't met anyone who has migrated to the United States, and I've been to many, many border towns, who want to leave. They want to be home with their families. They want to be safe, though. Women and children are at risk. There are many, many tragic stories that I know of where people have gotten killed for a variety of reasons. So that shouldn't have to happen. People should be able to stay home. And so what we have to do is make sure that Vice President Harris's work is funded and that the strategies are there to make sure that those issues that are challenging the citizens and residents of these countries are addressed at the root level.
You know, there's so many big stories this week. Another big story is infrastructure. President Biden announcing a bipartisan infrastructure deal this week. Here's the framework of it. $579 billion overall, $109 billion for roads and bridges, $66 billion for railways, $65 billion for broadband. Are you ready to vote yes?
First, we're just looking now at what the bill would entail and drilling down on many of the provisions. But let me tell you, I'm really pleased that the president said he's not going to sign one bill, but he's going to sign two. We have to have reconciliation for the second one to make sure that the childcare economy and that the care economy and that our children receive the type of permanency in terms of the child tax credit, all of the issues that are about human infrastructure, making sure that the jobs are there to move forward. You know, we've had a disastrous downturn in the economy. We've worked to make sure that now the resources are put back into institutions, businesses, and organizations to really lift people out of poverty. 8 million more people have fallen into poverty. So I'm looking at the bill. I hope that we can keep moving forward. I'm again have to congratulate the president for the agreement that he made, but know that we have to have both bills to move alongside to make sure that the total infrastructure package is what it should be, which involves caring for our human infrastructure.
Some of the Republican senators are saying that they feel a little misled, saying that you have to pass one and pass the other, that they were not necessarily going for some of that human infrastructure funding. Are you concerned that that could kill the deal?
Look, we know we have a lot of work to do. The negotiations have to move forward. I don't know what the Republicans are talking about. Their constituents have benefited from everything the Democrats have done, where we did not get one Republican vote. And so we have to keep moving forward to make sure that children receive the type of resources to be lifted out of poverty. We have to make sure that our caregiving economy is the foundation is there for good paying union jobs. And we have to make sure that all of the issues around climate are addressed and healthcare. And so they're going to, you know, keep at it, but we're going to keep at it also, and hopefully they'll see the light and do the work that's necessary to support their constituents. This is not about red states or blue states. This is about the American people, and we did it for their constituents before. Hopefully they'll be able to vote for their constituents' quality of life also.
You know, you are one of the best-known progressives in Congress. Another one of the best-known progressives in Congress is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, your colleague from New York. She tweeted a picture of all the white senators who negotiated this deal, and here's the caption. She put this out. The diversity of this bipartisan coalition pretty perfectly conveys which communities get centered and which get left behind when leaders prioritize bipartisan deal-making over inclusive lawmaking, which prioritizes delivering the most impact possible for the most people. Do you agree with her?
I certainly do. That was glaring. I mean, if no one recognized that as an issue and a problem, then they're, in many ways, tone deaf. I mean, it was quite prominent in terms of who's making the decisions, who's in the negotiations, and how the diversity and necessity for people of color to be elected of the Senate should be a high priority for us all.
Yeah, of course, California had an African-American woman in the Senate and now does not anymore. Let's go to another big story on the issue of race. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin sentenced to 22 years. That's on the higher end of sentencing. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, he should have received the maximum in terms of the sentencing. And I don't, you know, he's a murderer. And had he been African American, I'm sure he would have gotten the book. Having said that, he didn't get paroled. And the judge, I guess, tried to find a middle point, a compromise, unfortunately. And so that's I think we've cracked the door open. But I'm very disappointed that he didn't get the maximum sentence.
Now let's go to a big story that is a long time coming for you. Back in 2001, you were the only member of Congress to vote against the authorization of the Afghanistan war. At the time, you warned that it would be an endless war. Well, 20 years later, Congress finally siding with you and repealed that authorization. How does that feel? And are you telling them told you so?
No, I'm not, because we've lost several thousand of our brave troops. We've lost many, many people who were civilians in Afghanistan and surrounding areas. Many have become refugees. The security situation in many ways got very, very dicey and got worse. What you see now is finally a realization, and I'm really pleased that President Biden has called for our troops to come home. Having said that, we have to make sure that women and children are protected, that the security is what it should be. We've trained hundreds of thousands of Afghan security forces. But when I voted against the 2001 authorization, it was 60 words. And it was a blank check. It gave any president the authority to go to war forever. That's why I called it forever. It was the forever war authorization. And there's no way we should allow that authorization to be in place. It's been used 41 times at least in a declassified report by the Library of Congress in 19 countries, none of which are related to 9/11. Hmm. And so it was overly broad, and it took away members of Congress's responsibilities in terms of their constitutional responsibilities to vote yes or no for an authorization to use force if the president so chooses to go to war.
And of course, the House has now repealed it, and we will see what the Senate does next on that front.
Yes, and I have to just say there were many people around the country who helped me for the last 18 years on this, and it was a bipartisan vote. 49 Republicans voted with us, and the American Legion, Americans for Prosperity, and many groups that I'm not always aligned with came out in support of the repeal authorization.
Well, let's talk about some actual bipartisanship in Washington, which we don't see all that often. And this is another event you've said is a long time coming. That's the signing of a bill to make Juneteenth a national holiday. You were on stage with the president and the first vice president, who's African-American, to witness history up close. You got one of the pens. What was going through your mind in that historic moment?
Oh, so much was. I just have to tell you, first of all, it is a long time coming for this country to recognize African-Americans' freedom and the fact that it took 2 years to even allow us in Texas to know that we were free because the Confederacy didn't want us to know. And all the issues around being enslaved are now coming to light. So the public really understands the plight of African Americans and why we fight so hard for justice, because those chains of slavery still must be broken. But Juneteenth also is personal for me. I just have to say, and one of the reasons I was so excited to be there with the president and Vice President Harris, Opal Lee, and all my colleagues, is that my grandfather was born in Galveston, Texas in 1875, 10 years after General Granger came to Galveston to let the enslaved Africans know that they were free. But also my great-grandmother, Fanny Wilson, was born enslaved in one of the towns right around Galveston. And wow. So we always celebrated Juneteenth as a child. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. And in California, of course, those of us from Texas continue to celebrate it. And so now the entire country has a chance to be with us and has a chance to salute us. Black Lives Do Matter, and has a chance to really learn more about the history of African Americans and make a commitment to move forward for justice and equity and repairing the damage of the past 401 years.
I mean, were you thinking of that little girl growing up in El Paso and the fact that you're now at the White House and part of this ceremony?
Yes, I was, and I was thinking about, oh boy, it's been a struggle. And Dr. Maya Angelou says, you know, I am the dream and the hopes of the slaves, and still I rise. And so it's not just for me personally, but it's for every single African-American in this country who has had to fight so hard, just for justice. So this was one step toward justice and one step toward truth and one step toward racial healing. And now we have to move forward to repair the damage and pass H.R. 40, the Commission to Develop, to Study and Develop Reparations. So, yes, I thought that day, that moment, I thought about my mother, my grandfather, my great-grandmother, my family, and all of our history personally. But just know that that is part of the history of every Black American in this country.
What a hopeful place to end. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Congresswoman Lee. This week, we're actually putting out two different podcasts. So if you want a completely different perspective on pretty much everything, we talked with Michael Knowles, a conservative commentator with The Daily Wire, who's out with a new book called Speechless, just came out this week, about conservatives and language. Do a real deep dive in another edition of the Issue Is podcast, also out this week. We'll hope you'll listen to that. We'll hope you'll also give us your thoughts. Send me a message in social media at Alex Michelson, Alex with an E. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.